Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And Christy, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Robert Phillips about the fourth edition of his book, Coping with Lupus, A Practical Guide. This is really important. Lupus is one of those scary diseases. It affects 16,000 people each and every year that get diagnosed with it, new and above, and they live with the disease. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I think it'll be an important one of thinking of living with chronic illness. But first, we have good research that matters, some on the link between diet, drinks, and health.
And maybe we're going to be able to put that to rest.
I hope so. About cancer docs noticing or not noticing when there's family disagreement.
And we'll see if there's any disagreement between us about that research study. And then the third one is about copays. And do any of our listeners out there pay copays for their medications? And does it affect their kids and their diseases?
And lastly, about some doctors still being mistaken on IUDs, a form of contraception. We'll talk more about what that is.
Let's talk about this very first research that matters, which is about, diet, drinks, and health. And we've been kind of gone back and forth over the last couple of years with a little bit of research about diet. Soda lovers may have higher risk of diabetes and heart disease, but then maybe it's not the diet soda, but maybe it's the diet that counts. And this is what this research looks at.
And so this was a study of 4,000 Americans between the ages of 18 and 30, and they studied them over the next 20 years.
And the research was actually done, the lead researcher was at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Dr. Duffy.
And so 827 participants developed something called metabolic syndrome, which is a cluster of risk factors for heart problems and diabetes.
Sometimes when people have that obesity in their abdomen and they have elevated cholesterol levels and maybe sedentary.
And at first, they tried to tease out a link between the diet beverages and their risk of developing this metabolic syndrome over the next 20 years. And what they found was that it also had to do with the type of diet overall that a person takes in.
Yeah, those who had the highest rate of metabolic syndrome, 32%, were those who did drink some diet soda, but they had the typical Western diet, compared to others, like 20%, who developed the metabolic syndrome, who also drank the diet soda. So we're suggesting that it's this typical Western diet that did it, not the 20% who actually had a better diet but drank the diet soda.
So it doesn't give us a clear answer of the role of diet soda, but it does imply that there's more to it than just the diet drink itself, and that it has more to do with someone's overall diet than just the consumption of that one diet drink.
But what do you think, Christy? Do you think diet sodas really have anything to do with this metabolic syndrome?
No. I drink one a day, but I don't think it has to do with it. I think it has to do with someone's overall weight, their other diet and lifestyle.
I think you can drink diet soda safely and pay more attention to your diet
and overall
exercise.
Calories.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition. We'll put a link up on site.
Okay. The next one's about cancer doctors noticing family discord. So we're talking about disagreements between a patient and their primary caregiver, somebody, a spouse or a child who's taking on responsibility of getting the patient appointments, home care, comfort, meeting basic needs, if there's disagreement among the treatment plan.
And this particular study published in the journal Lung Cancer, they interviewed 134 patients with advanced lung cancer in the Midwest, and they also interviewed the primary caregivers and the oncologist.
About 71% of the time, the patient and the caregiver said there was no conflict between them, but in 11% of the pairs, they agreed that there were some problems.
And, what they found basically is that depending on which type of pairs, whether the maybe one a caregiver thought there was a problem, but the patient did not, or the other way around, or when they both thought there was a problem and the doctor did not, that in the small minority of times in which there was this disagreement, the oncologist, for the majority of those small amount of times, really did not was not aware that there was conflict. So that is a problem.
Well, and as a physician, if a loved one disagrees with the plan for treatment and there's conflict about that at home, we don't know for sure that this affects their health. But the concept is, for me as a physician, I would want to know to bring that out and have a conversation to at least to know what's going on at home and be supportive of the patient
and their loved one. And in a recent situation, Christy, having dealt with my father-in-law who was dying of pancreatic cancer, there were sometimes some disagreements among different family members and maybe the immediate family about what should be done. And the oncologist wasn't aware of this. Would it have been helpful if the oncologist was aware? Yes, I think it would have, because we could have perhaps facilitated resolution. In the end, we actually did resolve this, but I don't think the oncologist ever knew that we had these disagreements.
Interesting. Well, it speaks to perhaps that doctors should be trained more to ask these questions and to look into it.
Yeah, oncologists maybe need some training in some family systems therapy. I don't know if they get it, but they might need it.
Sounds like it's pretty common enough that it could be helpful for patients. So if you are a caregiver or a person who has cancer, I would encourage you, if there is any disagreement, to talk openly with your doctor about it.
Yeah. Our very next research that matters is about a study of co-payments, when you have to pay a little bit amount of money to get all your medicines. And this was a study among asthma that was actually in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Asthma in Children and Co-pays.
So 9,000 kids, and they looked at the average co-pays. They averaged about $150 per year. And depending on their insurance, the cost to the patient or their family ranged from $100 a year for the people with the best insurance, with the highest being $190 a year for those out-of-pocket expenses.
And the slightly higher medication costs were, as expected, tied to slightly fewer filled prescriptions and slightly more asthma-related hospitalizations, suggesting that, the more we require people to, even though it doesn't seem like a lot of money, money is a barrier to getting good care or better care sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, the difference of 2.4% of kids with the expensive group being hospitalized compared with a lower percent in the cheaper medication group, to me, that was pretty impressive. Hospitalizations cost a lot of money.
Right. So the insurance companies, thinking that they're saving money by making patients do co-pays, are actually, in the end, there was no difference in cost. So it actually, the insurance companies, I suspect, increasingly for across all kinds of medicines, are actually going to get rid of co-pays. They don't really save the health system money, and they don't lead to better care.
Wouldn't that be nice? I would love no copays. Okay, this last one is about the IUD, or intrauterine device, which is a really common form of birth control for women.
Yep, and Christy, when I was going through training, we were taught to do them and to put them in as family doctors, and I still do, but there was also this belief that, well, maybe they weren't so safe because they could be traced in some patients with increased infections. So I think we were a little bit discouraged from using them. Do you think that was right?
Well, I think it was new at the time, but over time we've learned that it really is very, very safe and very, very effective. And the other question is whether or not they're safe for women who've never had a baby. And the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, there are lots of different groups of OBGYNs who have come out saying, yes, it is safe. It's as effective as complete as getting your tubes tied, but then you can reverse it when you decide to have babies. So very, very effective and safe.
Yeah, this was in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology, appropriately based on a survey of almost 2,000 healthcare providers, and 30% though thought that the IUD was unsafe. Yet, it's actually safer than probably birth control pills in many cases, because people don't take the birth control pills as intended. It's probably safer than condoms because people don't use condoms.
And it may be cheaper. You do it right in the office. It's super easy. And it's a little more upfront cost, but maybe cheaper over time than paying those copays. There we go again on the birth control pills.
Yeah, we'll put some information about the Minerva IUD and
Mirena.
And Mirena. And I thought it was Mirena. And and the Paragard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Up on there, the progestin and the copper-based one about potentially their cost and the length of time that they're good for. So people who may be interested in learning more can find out more about them.
That's a great idea. Well, we are going to take a short break, but we've had a chance to talk about the IUD, about copays and affecting kids.
About the need to really talk about family discord, perhaps when you're dealing with cancer.
And a little bit about diet, drinks, and your health.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk with Dr. Robert Phillips about coping with lupus, a practical guide. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I are going to talk with Dr. Robert Phillips, a psychologist and author of 36 different books, about his new book, Coping with Lupus, A Practical Guide. And this is a fourth edition of a very popular and helpful book.
Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Phillips.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure being with you.
And I guess we should really, for our listeners, I think most people know what lupus is, but when we call lupus, define just for our listeners, though, what that kind of means when people hear that. And how did you get interested in writing not just one, but now four editions of what is clearly a very popular and best-selling book?
Lupus is an autoimmune disease in which the immune system, which normally fights foreign invaders to the body, for some still unknown reason, turns around and fights healthy tissue within the body. It can affect virtually any system in the body, which is one of the things that makes it so difficult first to diagnose and then to treat. I've been working with individuals with lupus for more than 30 years. I started by running support groups on Long Island, and after meeting with a number of people as a result of those support groups who really said there was not enough written material on lupus, I put out the first edition for Coping with Lupus in 1984. Then, since I'm a believer that any information that's provided to patients should be current, I updated it to make sure my book practiced what I preached.
Well, why did you get interested in support groups? I mean, what got you really interested? Like many things, I mean, I've got lots of patients, Christy does too. Unfortunately with this, it's a very, very difficult disease. Did you have some experience?
I really didn't. I mean, I knew a few people here and there that had lupus, but I was working with a patient for non-related reasons. And she liked the kind of thing that I did, and she was involved in the Long Island chapter of the Lupus Foundation of America and was planning on starting a group. And because she liked my approach to different things, she said, would you like to run it? And I said, that's fine. And so I did a crash course to learn as much as I could, but obviously my best education has come from the patients.
So thinking about a patient receiving this new diagnosis, how do you frame it for people of what that means for their life in terms of symptoms and duration? I know you go into a lot of factors of this in the book, but what are the kinds of symptoms and things people are facing with this new diagnosis?
Well, it really depends on how it affects them. And it's so hard to give them any definitive answer because some people will be diagnosed for certain symptoms, but they may develop others and some don't develop others. And what they have at the beginning is what they have for the duration. It's hard to predict how it's going to play out. One of the things that I always say is the only sure thing about lupus is that there's no sure thing about lupus.
Mm.
It's one of the things that makes it so difficult to live with. But that's where I come in. I basically say, look, it's difficult to deal with the physical thing. There are always things you can do to help yourself physically. But what you want to do is you want to improve your ability to cope with it because, after all, this is going to be your accompaniment for the rest of your life since it's a chronic illness. It waxes and wanes. You go through flares and remissions, hopefully. And the goal is to do the best you can despite it rather than saying that the only way you'll be happy is if it goes away.
Well, I know one of the things, I was looking at some of the people who've reviewed your previous editions of your book, and one of the things they say is there was such a delay in diagnosis for many of them, and that they found your book was hopefully to be utilized to help empower people to who maybe have symptoms that could be lupus to go talk with their doctors, maybe doctors who read it to have more of an awareness. And in medical school and training, this was called one of the great masqueraders. You were taught that to not underestimate that it could present so many ways. So was that why, one of the reasons why you hope that the book is useful, that it helps people get diagnosed earlier?
Absolutely. You know, one of the phrases that I've heard most often from people who have read the book, and I say this because I'm quoting them, not because it's me, but they've called the book their Bible, because this is something that's taken a scary disease of unknown origin and unknown prognosis and has turned it into something that they can learn to live with. And by realizing that the things they're feeling are not as abnormal as they originally thought, that's a very important first step, and it helps them to move forward in the coping process.
So as you have a whole chapter on living with lupus and another on lupus and your emotions, what do you recommend to people as steps to look towards developing additional coping skills or framing things in a way that helps people live with this chronic illness?
That's a good question, Christy. And what I do is I start off basically by telling people, look, this is going to be part of you. So the first step really is to understand how you're being affected by it, but not just physically, also by emotionally. What are the things that are bothering you about it? Is it bothering you that you may have to change your lifestyle? Does it bother you that you may have to change your vocational situation? How about relationships? How about emotions? How about behaviors? Each person needs to pinpoint specific ways that lupus is going to affect them, and the book basically covers all of those ways along with suggestions and strategies for things that people can do. But because there are so many ways that lupus can affect any given individual, and it never affects one person in all of those ways, the first step is to help to crystallize in their own mind how it affects them.
We're talking to Dr. Robert Phillips about his book, Coping with Lupus, A Practical Guide. And Dr. Phillips, it would appear that there are certain symptoms, though, that are kind of uniform to a lot of people who have chronic illness, and certainly lupus, things like pain and things like fatigue. What role do diet, nutrition, exercise play in helping people with lupus to really deal with those kind of common symptoms?
A big help. Any problem, any disease, any situation can be helped by taking better care of your physical health as far as nutrition, as far as exercise. All of those things are concerned. If you smoke, cut back. If you can't eliminate it, if you drink, cut back. If you can't eliminate it, do all the right things, because it immediately gives you something you can do. One of the biggest problems for people with lupus is that sudden onset of a feeling of being out of control. Lupus is now controlling me. My life is being controlled by lupus. That's scary for somebody who's always felt that they were in control of their life. So the way to conquer that is to start taking control back, because there are always things you can do to improve your life, and diet is a great way to do it, and it can help your symptoms. Exercise is a great way to do it, and it can help your symptoms. Now, there probably are some listeners saying that, you know, if I'm dealing with a lot of pain from lupus, how can I exercise? And the answer is there are always things you can do. I've told people, I don't care if you just exercise your pinkies. Do something, and you'll feel better.
Do you think
you're helping yourself?
Active part of doing something, or the exercise itself of moving the body?
Both. Exercise provides both a physiological and a psychological benefit. And so it doesn't matter how much of each type of benefit is provided, it's going to benefit you. So it's worth doing.
And what about the things that people might normally shy away with from a chronic disease, like intimacy between partners, or the types of other concerns like traveling? I know you've got some thoughts about this. What concrete tips can you recommend for maybe couples who would like to be able to still continue with their lives but also are dealing now with chronic disease?
I have a chapter on intimacy, and I have a chapter on travel, and I believe that the most important tool for couples now dealing with lupus is communication. They've got to be able to talk about it. The biggest problems in relationships is when problems pop up and they don't talk about it, or they don't talk about it constructively. As far as intimacy is concerned, there are always things that people can do to enjoy an intimate life. The key is that they have to figure out what's going to work given all circumstances, given any limiting factors, any things that may be going on, and then tune in to those obstacles that may occur. For example, pain. For example, another example is that some people with lupus develop a dryness syndrome called Sjogren's syndrome, where it may be more painful to be intimate. Well, there are things that can be done, but the first thing to do is to identify that and work on that. My philosophy, and it courses through the book, is that there are always things you can do to improve the things that affect you, so never stop trying and never give in to the disease and say, the disease is controlling me and I can't do the things I want to do.
That is wonderful advice. There's so much hope and power in that message. Dr. Phillips, we are going to need to take a short break, but listeners, when we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Robert Phillips, about his book, Coping with Lupus, A Practical Guide. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with psychologist and best-selling author Dr. Robert Phillips about the fourth edition of his book, Coping with Lupus, A Practical Guide. And before we had the break, Dr. Phillips, you were talking about really helping families develop strategies of communicating and talking with each other that was really kind of practical. I wonder if you can think about a situation maybe that you've encountered recently with families that would illustrate ways that this maybe works or ways where it didn't work.
Probably easier to point out a way that it doesn't work, because there are so many individuals with lupus that face this problem, and that is if you don't get the support of your family. What if you're a woman, for example, with lupus, and your husband doesn't believe you? Or your husband isn't supportive, or your husband says that you're malingering. What do you do then?
Because you can't see it physically outward. The person just says, I'm in pain, I don't feel good, I can't breathe, my skin is dry.
Yeah, in some cases you can see it. There are rashes of lupus, there is a bloating that comes if patients are on prednisone. So there are things that are absolutely noticeable. But regardless, I've encountered spouses that see it and still can't deal with it, so they back off. So their communication is more difficult because they don't want to be bothered. You know, there were many times that I would run support groups and I would invite the spouse to come and they never showed up. So what I would do is I would then work on skills for the person living with the disease to improve their ability to express themselves to their family member. And if that didn't work, then work on coping strategies to help them better deal with the fact that they may just not get the support that they would like to get.
We do know that patients who have any form of chronic illness are more likely to have depression. And I wonder, to the extent that that also applies to lupus, is that something that you see often sort of confounding the picture in those relationships and in the process of coping?
Absolutely. In fact, if you show me somebody with lupus who has never experienced any depression at all, I wonder why. I wonder what they're on, to be facetious. But seriously, the reality is, how can you not? Your life is changing in ways that you did not want it to change. So you can be depressed because of what you're dealing with. You can be depressed because of your concerns about the future. You can be depressed about the way your life is changing. The chapter in the book goes into all of those and many other causes for depression. But depression and any other negative emotion is mediated by negative thoughts. The thoughts are what leads to these emotions. And so what that does is it gives people the opportunity to learn how to change their thinking, because if they can improve their thinking, then they can improve their emotions.
Well, and along with that, correlation, and it occurs to me reading through your book that you could almost transpose some of the elements of lupus as you go through the different elements of coping and emotions and relationships that could apply to many other chronic illnesses and
Absolutely.
Help a lot of people.
And that's been the cornerstone of a number of other books that I've written where in my coping series, where I've talked about how these strategies are not exclusive to lupus. They really apply to a lot of other diseases, a lot of other situations in life. But in this book, I'm really focusing on prioritizing lupus because of the specifics of the disease, the interaction with the emotions, and then the strategies that are useful to help people deal with it.
Well, Dr. Phillips, I can imagine that anger, as it does many times, is part of this continuum of emotions that patients with lupus and their family members feel. Anger at the diagnosis, anger at the lack of a cure, anger at the doctors who may not believe them, and family members. Is there ever anger at you and your book? Because you are so full of hope, which is to me is like perfect, but I wonder if sometimes people with their anger turn it towards, you know, that you don't know what it's like to live with this. You don't know what it's like. How do you deal with that? Because you really are putting out a message of self-empowerment and hope, but sometimes maybe that's hard for people to hear.
It's a good question, Adam. And yes, I have encountered that not very often, fortunately. I guess the people who are most angry and don't necessarily ascribe to the message are people that I don't end up hearing from or may not even get the book or may not even come to one of my meetings. But there are people who are very angry, or they'll look at the book and say, well, what's that going to do for me? So what I do if I get the opportunity to speak to such a person is I try to draw out from them why they're angry, why initially they're directing it at me, and try to get them to clarify in their own mind what the real reason for the anger is. Maybe they're angry because they don't feel any hope at all, and here I am talking about hope. Or maybe they've already gone through some major changes or major losses in their life, loss of a relationship, loss of a job, whatever, because of lupus, and they can't really jive with the message of hope that the book is trying to convey.
And that's an important message, I think, that you're just relaying, that actually primary care doctors like Christy and myself need to be able to give to patients living with this disease, because I think, you know, you are touching on really something that's really near and dear to us.
Yeah, and it's so very important. So many times people will say to me as a psychologist, how are you going to help me? You can't make my lupus go away. And I answer them in two words, try me. And basically, then what I do is I focus on specifics. I'll break it down with them. I don't start off by saying, be hopeful and start preaching to them. Basically, what I'll do is, as I said, try to draw out from them what is making them angry. What are the specific factors that are bothering them the most? And then I try gently to guide them into recognizing that there are all different ways of looking at all of these things. If they're angry because they lost a relationship, okay, well, that's done. You can't do anything to resurrect that relationship. But does that mean you spend the rest of your life waiting to die and not do anything about it? Or do you say, okay, that's done. Where do I go from here? And you start exploring from a more practical point of view what they can do next.
Speaking of relationships between the patient and the provider, you talk about relationships with friends, with physicians, with support groups. Thinking about a primary care physician, a rheumatologist perhaps, what are the most important things from your perspective for the patient to know and to invest in those relationships, and then also for the physician to know in empowering patients?
Well, I think the first answer that popped into my head would benefit both sides, and that is be precise in the things you want to discuss. If the patient is going to go in for an office visit, patients should be prepared with their questions, reports of their symptoms. If there are symptoms that are bothering them, rather than just saying, okay, I'm experiencing this, this, and this, ask questions about it. What does this mean? What can I do about that? So on. But be prepared to make the best use of time that you've got, because otherwise the doctor is going to be thinking about the next patient and that the entire caseload is going to be backloaded for the day, and they're not going to be able to be as informative and communicative as both sides would like them to be. The physician, on the other hand, can basically encourage preparation of lists and ongoing lists to be built up in between appointments so that when the person comes in, they're ready to talk about the things that are most important.
Great advice.
You know, in the last minute or so, you do have at the end of your book, really, you are talking about hope, but you're also talking about ongoing research and clinical trials. What would be your recommendation if you did have a loved one or a relative or a friend diagnosed with lupus? How would you counsel them about the kind of research and being able to maybe participate in clinical trials? What do you say?
It's a great question. And what's interesting is that to preface my answer to that, there are a lot of people who are overwhelmed because of their life with lupus. The last thing they want is all of their well-meaning family members and friends calling them and telling them about the latest solution that they read about in the National Enquirer, because, you know, not only can that be dangerous, but it can give false hope. So I usually suggest a rather unusual idea, and that is that I suggest that each patient pick a designated information recipient. So if friends or family want to call, they call somebody else. Give them that information and let that person be the go-between so that the person with lupus is not overwhelmed.
That's a good idea.
But research into research is what I recommend. Look for the latest clinical trials that are going on. Speak to your physician. Check with a chapter of the Lupus Foundation of America or Lupus Alliance or any of the lupus groups that really have connections with that. Learn how to do some research online. And in the book, I have a list of resources in the back that indicate some of the websites where you can get current information not only on clinical trials, but how to find out new and innovative clinical trials. And keep an open mind to the things that are going on, but make sure that anything you do is reputable because there's still too much witchcraft out there.
That's great advice. Well, speaking of websites, you have a website or a link where people can go to find out more information about your book or more information about lupus.
Well, the website is coping.com, which is very easy to remember, www.coping.com. And if people would like to contact me via email, and I answer my emails personally, you can email me at drphillips@coping.com. There's no punctuation, drphillips@coping.com. In addition, for your listeners, Adam and Christy, if anybody would like to learn a relaxation procedure that I have taught to people all over the world, I have a brief procedure that is referred to in Coping with Lupus called the Quick Release. It's a two-minute procedure, and I have it on an MP3 file. And if you email me and request that file and said that, you know, say that you'd listen to us on this terrific show, I'll be happy to email it out to you with no charge.
That sounds great.
So nice.
I know you're going to get at least two requests.
That's right. We need some.
In the near future, and we certainly will put a link up to the book on our site. And we really want to thank you, Dr. Phillips, author of a fourth edition of Coping with Lupus, a practical guide for really being practical advice for your health listeners. Thank you so much for your time and concern.
My pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For House Calls segment, Christy, we'll talk with our listeners and hear their concerns.
And if you have a question you want us to address, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we have some house calls today about chest pain and what could it be if it's not your heart.
About medicine bottles and pill boxes.
About if you have reflux of acid that doesn't respond to anti-reflux medications.
And about having allergies to antibiotics and how to go through life with that situation. Okay, let's take our very first house call question about chest pain.
I have chest pain several times a month, really bad. In the past, I was told it's not my heart, and I know it probably comes from stress, which I have a tremendous amount of in my life. My question is this: how does the stress cause me to have chest pain? Can it still affect my heart even though I do not have heart disease?
You know, that's a really good question, because I think, Christy, you know, we do a really good job sometimes of telling patients and their family members in the emergency room, well, this is not your heart, but we have a harder time kind of saying what it is, and we kind of talk in about reflux and spasm of the esophagus. But a lot of people do have stress, and they do have chest pain.
And it raises the question, is that because you feel some pain related to your muscles and joints and you're so stressed or anxious that you think it's your heart? Or is there something really going on with your heart that has to do with the stress?
And I don't know if we can do full justice to this question, but there are increasing amounts of research that stress itself can play a role in causing heart dysfunction, sometimes at that microvascular level or that heart level that's maybe even sometimes beyond our ability to measure it. So people could have some pain that may be related to their heart, even though we can't even measure it.
It's true. I mean, it's unclear how much that really affects someone's long-term outcome for their heart. But we do know stress puts you at higher risk of developing heart disease.
And there is, if you have severe stress, there is this syndrome. I've heard it called stress cardiomyopathy.
Takotsubo. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But it's like where you can get a heart attack or heart failure from a broken heart. I've seen this in a patient who had her husband die and was so sad. And that, I mean, it's real, where you get real EKG changes and real changes in heart failure that can come from this.
And this excessive stress, the sympathetic outpouring of these hormones stimulates short-term complete breakdown of the ventricle, the heart. And yet for most of those patients, they actually recover fully.
That's the good news.
So this can go from a whole spectrum here, but it's clear that stress can be related to your heart. So we hope that attention to the stress can maybe relieve some of that pain.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our next house call question.
I went to the doctor recently and brought my medicines in all the bottles. He told me, however, that I needed to bring my pillbox too, as he wanted to see and have a discussion about what I actually take every day. Is this now what all doctors are doing? Is it a matter of trust?
Well, your doctor has given you good advice, I'll tell you that, because it is really hard from the physician point of view, and Adam and I are seeing patients on multiple medicines, to tease out what people are actually taking. And it helps communication so much if you'll bring your medicines and your pill box.
You know, it's really difficult sometimes if you're on 10 or 11 medicines and you bring in the 10 or 11 bottles, for me to count all the pills and all the bottles to find out, you know, when did I last prescribe them? Did you miss some doses? You know, if we're really trying to decide, are you taking all your medicines and maybe how many times you miss it? But you open that pill box and it's Thursday and I see Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then you're supposed to have 10 pills a day and there are only 5 pills a day and 3 of those pills are still there. Well, I know I've got to do a better job of talking with you and your family members there versus a pill box that is exactly the way it was supposed to be.
And I don't think it's a matter of trust. I think it's more a matter of how confusing it is to take so many different medicines. So if I'm asking a patient, how do you fill your pill box? It's much easier if we have the pill box right there for you to show me who fills it, how does it get filled, and how do you take that each day?
We're big pill box fans.
Yes, we are.
No downside that we're aware of. So and they don't seem to be all that expensive. So we recommend it.
Yep, bring it in. Show it to your doctor.
Let's listen to our very next house call.
I have severe reflux of acid, and it is not really being helped by the over-the-counter and prescription meds that the doctors recommend. I have had a gastroenterologist look down in my stomach and confirm that I have acid reflux and a small hiatal hernia, and I do all the dietary things I'm supposed to do. What should I do next?
Fascinating that the medicines or those proton pump inhibitors that doctors recommend and that you can get over the counter now are very, very, very effective for symptoms of acid reflux. And I'm sad to hear that you're not getting relief from that.
And, you know, we should take what you're saying at face value, because not every patient gets relief from these medicines. It's possible there are other factors going on, like the wrong diagnosis or an additional diagnosis that you might have, or sometimes are people actually taking the medicines exactly right? But let's assume you are taking them and that the diagnosis was correct.
The other thing I think is important to think about, and assuming it is true acid reflux, is the diet changes, the changing the position of your bed at night. You can increase the head of your bed, but doing some of those, eating smaller, more frequent meals, doing some of those lifestyle changes and making sure you've done those things first before giving up.
And if indeed you have done those and they didn't work, what was usually recommended at this point in time is actually you see a gastroenterologist and you actually have them take a look down with that procedure called EGD, look into your stomach, and actually even check the pressure readings there to see if there's some other conditions. And ultimately, you might actually have to consider potentially even a surgical approach.
There is something called a Nissen fund application that is done often, or not often, but sometimes in babies who have severe reflux, and also is sometimes required of adults who have this
problem. It used to be done a lot more frequently before we had the medications as kind of a way of kind of curing this reflux, sometimes helping out this hiatal hernia that sometimes is there. We'll put some information about this on our website. It's more than we can get into today, but there are alternatives.
And our health sciences librarians will be helpful to get us the right information on our website. Okay, let's take our last house call question of the day.
When I was a toddler, I had allergic reactions to both penicillin and sulfa drugs with severe hives and swelling. I'm in my 40s now. Is there any chance that I may have grown out of these, and how can I find out? My doctor wants to put me on a sulfonamide, but I'm worried I'll be allergic.
Well, the first thing we would need to know is what type of allergic reaction you had as a child. Because a lot of times people might have a little bit of a rash, and that's very different than your skin on your hands and your feet kind of peeled off and you had a fever and other kinds of problems.
Right. And if it truly was severe hives and swelling, then I would be very cautious. And I think the question is, can you go through your life without penicillin and sulfa drugs? Are there other antibiotics that can be useful for whatever infection that you have and try to avoid them if possible?
And there are, for most conditions, there are alternative antibiotics. If you absolutely had to take one of these, mm-hmm. we would probably recommend that you perhaps work with an allergist to understand, either get tested, perhaps in the case of penicillin to see if you're truly allergic, or in the case of sulfa, you could potentially work on a desensitization. If you didn't have a severe allergic reaction, you start with very low doses of exposure to the medicine.
Hopefully that's helpful information to you. Adam, we should do a whole show just on allergies to antibiotics and medications.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you for sending in your house calls to us. And we want you to send us your house calls at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and on our blog. Get free podcasts of the show.
And or go to our help, Your Health. If you, one word, you search for that for Android or iPhone, and you can download it free to your phone.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Robert Phillips. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll talk with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.